Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about pipelining, which is how we're going to take our sequential y86 processor and make it into a faster processor. But we're going to start out with a completely non-electronics example and talk about doing laundry. So here's a way I could do my laundry. I have two loads to do, my whites and my colored. So I'll start out, I'll put my whites in the washer, wait for that to finish, then move them to the dryer, wait for that to finish, and then put them on my table, fold them all, and I'm all put away. Then I can start my colors and put that in the washer, then wait for that to finish, put it in the dryer, and so on. Does anyone here do their laundry like this? Have multiple loads? Any here do it in a different way? So what do you do? Yeah. It doesn't make sense to not be using the washer for this whole amount of time if it's there. So most people, if they have multiple loads of laundry, would do that. You start using the washer right away for your next load rather than waiting the whole time. And this means that essentially all the time, almost all the time, we're taking full advantage of our washer and our dryer and our folding space. So we're getting a lot better efficiency out of what we have. There's still a little bit of waste. We have a little bit of time that we're spending with our equipment where it's not being used, but we've gotten a lot better efficiency than if we just did one load and waited for that to all be done and then did another one. So there's a little bit of waste of time, but it's not so bad. And this is a logical thing to do, and it means that as far as how much work we're getting done overall, we're getting a lot more work done. But because of this wasted time, it's a little slower. And in fact, it's a bit worse in reality because my dryer is not super fast like that previous diagram showed. It takes a lot longer than my washer. So it means most of the time I'm waiting for my dryer. So from the time I start doing my colors to finishing it, it's a lot longer than it would be otherwise because I have this time in the middle here where I'm just waiting. But it's still a lot more efficient, it's still worth doing. So we're spending, in this case, a little over 2 hours to do each load of laundry once we get started, when we could be spending a little less than 2 hours. So our latency, that is our time from starting to finishing, is a bit higher because we're doing this pipelining of starting one thing right after another in this sort of assembly line fashion. So as far as measuring our time to get one load of laundry done, I've made things worse. But most people think it's worth doing this and would do this in reality because they're thinking about not the rate of getting one load of laundry done, but the rate of getting a bunch of them done. So if I'm doing laundry all the time, with this mechanism, I'm getting about one load done every hour, which is as good as I can do because that's exactly how fast my dryer is. So the slowest thing I have limits the speed I can do. But I'm doing much faster than if I waited for everything to do each step. So this means our throughput, amount of work we get done per unit time, is a little over a load an hour, assume once we get started. So in exchange for making each thing take longer, we made more things get done. And a notable thing, if you want to measure throughput, because we have to wait for something to finish before we can put something in, because we can only have one thing in the washer and one thing in the dryer and one thing on our folding table at a time, if you look at the rate at which things finish, that's going to be the same as the rate at which things start. And the same at the rate at which things enter or leave any stage of our laundry here. So we're going to take this idea where we can allow things to take longer, but take advantage of having multiple things we can use that really can act in parallel and get more work done overall. But the exchange we're going to make is that each thing we're doing is going to be a little slower. So if we care how long individual things take, this is not worth doing. But if we care how long the mass of things takes, this is going to be worth doing. So before I talk about how we apply this to circuits, are there questions, comments? Okay, so let's move from the land of laundry, where humans are moving things around, to circuits. And I have a toy circuit here, which non-intelligently multiplies a number times 3. And if we look at what this is going to do over time, so we're going to get an input A, and once that input is stable, this first adder is going to eventually, after some delay, however long it takes to do its computation, start outputting 2 times A. So it's going to take some time to do that, just because these signals need to propagate through the gates in the adder. And after this 2 times A is stable at the input to the second adder can start propagating the real result for 3 times A. And so sometime later after that, we'll have our final answer of what 3 times A is. So if we imagine that the time it takes for each adder to go from having a stable input to giving you an answer is 50 picoseconds, then that means we have a timeline like this, where we start out by inputting a value, in this case 7, on our blue wires. And at this point, this adder can start doing useful work. It can take that stable input, and 50 picoseconds later, produce a stable output of 14. And once that stable output is there, along with the input that was already ready 50 picoseconds earlier for A to the second adder can start working. And 50 picoseconds later, it can produce our final answer of 21. And you notice, just like with the laundry scenario, we have our adder here, which is not doing any useful work in our last 50 picoseconds. It's just sitting there, outputting the same value it has been outputting. It already did the work of doing the addition. And if only we had that value somewhere, we wouldn't need it anymore. We kept it somewhere. And similarly, the second adder has nothing useful to do for the first 50 picoseconds. And wouldn't it be nice if we could have it do something useful during that first 50 picoseconds? And our solution is going to be to apply the same thing we did to laundry to this situation of, after this first adder finishes, we're going to give it some new work to do. And this is going to let us increase the throughput. So right now, it takes 100 picoseconds from the time we have a stable input to this first adder to the time we get a stable output from the last adder. So our throughput is 10 results per nanosecond. So we can multiply times 3 10 times per nanosecond. And what that might look like if we used it is that, so we could provide a new input every 100 picoseconds and get a new answer after 100 picoseconds and do something with it. And what we're going to do instead is we're going to get rid of this idle time for each of the adders by inputting a number every 50 picoseconds, roughly the rate at which the adders finish. And so they'll always have work to do. So we'll compute the same sequence of numbers, but we'll get results more frequently. So the rate at which we're putting in numbers is 1 every a little more than 50 picoseconds, and the rate at which we're getting numbers out is 1 a little more than every 50 picoseconds. It has to be the same. So our throughput is substantially higher. So to make this happen, we have a bit of a problem, which is that while we're computing this second addition here for the first adder, we need to make sure that the second adder is getting the value 14 and not something that's related to 17. We want to compute in the second stage the value for the first input, not the first input mixed with our second input. And the way we're going to do that is by storing the result of the first adder somewhere. And the way we know to store things, the easiest way we know to store things, is a register. So we're going to add registers. So at some time t, we're going to have a register which contains values for the input from for the output for time t, and the output for the next time, and the following time. So we're going to store the intermediate values in the registers. And these registers, depending on where they are, will store values for different computations, computation values which enter the system at different times. So if we apply this to the example we had, that initially we're going to input this 7. And we're going to store it in a register. That's how we're going to get an input. And this register will be outputting 7. So this adder can work on that number 7 and output 14 by the time this green register needs to read that value. Then to do the rest of the computation of 7 times 3, we're going to need to add this 14 that we store in that register and 7. And in order to add 7 and not our second input 17, we needed to place a second register here. We needed to make sure that we delayed the value the second stage got appropriately. We can't just say it's the A, because there's different A's depending on what stage you're in. So we need to have a register here, and that's going to store 7 after the first clock cycle. So this barrier here and this barrier here is a rising edge of a clock, because that's when registers take in a value and change what they output. So during our second clock cycle, this adder is going to be adding this 7 it got copied from the first cycle, and 14, which it got from the first adder, and producing 21 as the input, so the last register. In the meanwhile, our first adder is going to be adding 17 and 17 from the next request of what we want to multiply by 3. So finally, after two rising edges of the clock, we finally get our answer of 21 available. Questions, comments about this? So an issue I glossed over earlier is exactly how fast this is. So I talked about our adders taking about 50 picoseconds. And you might say, well, that means that this blue bar here is 50 picoseconds. That's how long the adder needs. And in an ideal world, that might be true. But some of our components here, notably our registers, aren't going to be ideal. So if you remember, the way our registers work is that they take an input, and then a rising edge of a clock happens, and they just change their outputs. And the way we've talked about it so far is we've said that at that rising edge of the clock, instantaneously, their output changes. But that's not what really happens. The registers need a bit of time for that to happen. So there's two issues. So one issue is that the registers can't figure out what electrical signal is there instantaneously. They need some time for the signal to be stable in order to work properly. So there's some period before the rising edge of the clock during which the value that the register is getting has to stay the same, or else we don't know what the register is going to store. So we need to give the register some little extra time in order to read that value. There's also some time after the rising edge of the clock where the register's output is going to be changing from whatever the blue value is to the green value, and that can't be quite instantaneous. And when we put these together, we get what I'm going to call the register delay. And that's going to be an issue for our pipelining, because we need to store things in registers. And in order to have things in registers, we're going to need to wait this amount of time at the end of each cycle and this amount of time at the beginning of each cycle in order for our adders to do their useful work. since our adders can't do work while they need to keep the same output for the register, and they can't do work while the input they're getting is changing. So that means that we think about what the timing of this pipeline is, that each of these registers is going to take, let's say, if the register delay is 10 picoseconds, we're going to need to account for 10 picoseconds to go through that register, the total time both before the clock cycle and after. In addition to that, we'll have our 50 picoseconds that the adder takes. So the time for each clock cycle that we need is going to be a register and the circuitry after it, the path from a register to another, the next register. And on this circuit, that's going to be 50 picoseconds. We need to get from one register through an adder to get to the next register. That's the longest path we have. It doesn't help us that sometimes we go directly from a register to a register because we're constrained by what takes the longest, and that's going to be the adder. So we can get one operation every 60 picoseconds, which is about 16 billion operations per second, which is substantially better than the what we started with, the 10 we started with, 10 billion we started with. Yes?
Do ALUs have their own clock separate from the CPU?
In this course, no. ALUs have no clock. So they just, like in, so the question was, do ALUs have a separate clock? So like in this diagram, they just take in a value and sometime later they output something. And there's no, the clock signal here is, you know, there's no clock involved. There doesn't need to be a clock. They just, you know, start working when the inputs become stable. They're also working when they're not, they just don't produce a useful answer. So that's the model for this class. Real ALUs sometimes will be pipelined, but that's not a topic we will deal with. Other questions? Okay, so we've gotten things up from 10 billion to 16 billion. Can we do better? And, you know, one thing you might say is that, well, why do we limit ourselves to splitting this in half? We could split it into more pieces. So if we could just do half the first half of the add, and then stash the results somewhere, then do the second half of the add, we'd be waiting a lot longer for our answers because a value would need to go through five registers to get out. But we could put in values more frequently, so we get higher throughput. So if we imagine we could just divide the operation of adding a number into two pieces, and we got some partial results in the middle, and we just store that in a register, we might say that, oh, we can take 25 picoseconds to get our partial results, drop that in a register, and then we're ready to take the next value in. So we're getting one operation every 35 picoseconds, and we can get up to, say, 28 billion operations per second. Not quite done. And this is, you know, a nice idea for improving our performance. It seems a bit tricky. So there's two issues I'm going to talk about. So one is, let's say we can do this. Let's say I can figure out how to divide that add up into two pieces. And, you know, it happens to split nicely. How much faster could we get? Can we actually make this program, multiply by three, you know, that much faster? Can we make it, you know, up to a trillion operations a second? What's our limit? And the second question is whether we can even do this. Because there's a question to be asked about, you know, is it really practical to split up the ad like this? And what's our real scenarios going to look like? You know, how much pipelining can we actually do? So starting with the first question, let's think about the ideal case. We start out, we have 100 picoseconds of logic. Those two adds take 100 picoseconds. Let's assume we can just split it as arbitrarily, and we get exactly the ideal split. If we split into three pieces, we get 333 picoseconds and change chunks. That seems pretty hard to do, but let's assume that we can figure that out. So in this case, you know, as we split it more and more, that 10 picoseconds we need to wait for the registers is going to become more and more significant. So already when we split it into three pieces, it's more than 25% of our cycle time. So, and it gets worse and worse. So in the limit, we can like divide this into 100 single picosecond pieces, and how to do that seems very hard to imagine. But if you could do that, you'd be spending most of your time waiting for the registers. And that's going to be our limit in performance. And this means that the way our pipelining works is that our time for each completion, our throughput rate, is going to be limited by this register delay. So the register delay is going to be the floor on how fast we can get things into or out of the system. And this means that when we add our initial pipeline stages, we're going to get a big benefit. So moving from one stage, doing both of the adds in the same cycle, to two, got us almost a 2x speedup, just 13% off. So pretty close to twice as fast. But if when we start moving from like 14 to 15, we're getting like 2% better performance for all that added complexity. And the real situation is going to be a little worse. Because usually, we're not going to think of a way of, say, taking an add and dividing it into two equal pieces that are exactly equally split. Usually, we'll have to make some sort of compromise. We'll take some piece of logic and divide it into two pieces which are different sizes. And maybe the two pieces are overlapped when we do them in one cycle, but they can't be overlapped anymore. So the sum might even be longer. So this means that we don't get quite an even split, so our returns are a little worse than the ideal. And generally a lot worse the more and more that register delay starts mattering. So any questions about this, the general trade-off, before we move on to applying this to our processors? So we're going to start looking at applying this to our processors. And it seems really attractive for our processors because the thing we really care about with our Y86 processor is not latency, but is throughput. We want to get a lot of instructions done. We don't really care if each instruction takes a little longer, so long as we're doing a lot of them. And we've been preparing to do this pipelining secretly because we divided our processor into stages. And this is the real reason we did it, is that we have these stages here. We have our fetch, which I'm grouping with our PC update, even though that was a separate stage in the textbook. So a fetch and PC update stage. Then a decode stage where we read our registers. An execute stage where we do whatever computation the instruction does. And since we don't have memory here, I'm omitting that. And so we follow it with a write back stage. And the way we're going to pipeline our processor is that our pipeline stages, the individual steps we're going to do, and we're going to store values and registers in between, is going to be exactly these stages. Because we definitely know how to do each of these stages independently. They don't require us to do anything funny, like divide an adder into two pieces, or divide an instruction memory into two pieces. So one piece of preparation we're going to have for doing that is just like with this pipeline, where we needed to put this extra register here because we needed to make sure that values went from one stage to the next and didn't skip a step. So we had the values from the current instruction and not the next one. We need to make sure in preparation that when we have a value like this destination register number, which goes from our fetch to our write back, we don't want that. Because this it goes from fetch to write back instead of going through the next stages, which is decode, then execute, then write back. So as a preparation for turning this into a pipeline processor, I'm going to move this wire here, and just, you know, which skips some stages, and just redraw it so it goes through every stage in turn. And our rule is going to be we always want to go through every single stage, even if we don't use the value in some stages. We might just be passing the value through. And after we've done this, we're going to need to add registers, because we're going to want to do our fetch and then get whatever values we fetch from the instruction memory, put them somewhere, so we can fetch something else now. So we're no longer using the output of the instruction memory. Apparently, I do not have a microphone, so I'll have to speak louder. So that means that we're going to want some registers between every one of these stages. So we're going to have between the fetch and the decode, we're going to put registers between the decode and execute, and between execute and write back. Every barrier, we're going to put registers for every wire which crosses. And so what that ends up is something like this. We have our fetch into our decode. So we put our A and our B in some registers there. Then we have between our decode, where we get our register outputs, and our execute. And we put our two register read values in some pipeline registers, along with the value we're passing all the way to the write-back stage that we don't need right away, which we need to still pass through. The execute stage does the add, and between the execute and write-back stage, we need to store both the result of that add, which we're going to send to the register file during the write-back stage, and that register number we're passing just through the execute stage. So we can label each of these as sort of logically as what stages they bridge. You've seen any time we're bridging between two stages, we need some registers between them. So we also have a case where we're passing values with registers between two stages that I haven't highlighted yet, and that's our program counter. And that's sort of a special case. So with these registers, we're passing a value for the same instruction to the next stage. With the program counter, we're passing a value for the next instruction to the same stage. So we're passing from the fetch stage to the fetch stage, but that's okay because we're doing it between the fetch stage of one instruction and the fetch stage of the next instruction. But for all the other cases, we want to be working on one instruction at a time. So this is between fetch and decode for the same instruction. So the way this looks with some example instructions is let's take this sequence of adds. We'll add R8 and R9, then R10 and R11, and see how that looks being executed by this pipeline. So the first thing that's going to happen is we're going to start executing this first instruction. So that means that the PC somehow is going to start with, in our first clock cycle, outputting the address of this instruction. That's going to go to the instruction memory, and our instruction memory is going to output the actual machine code for the instruction, and that's going to end up being the input to these registers. At the same time, we're going to compute the next program counter value, which is the value for the fetch stage of the next instruction, so the address of instruction 2. And that's going to be sitting on the input to this PC register. And these are just sitting on the input to those registers, and once the rising edge of the clock happens, the register reads the values from the input and it starts outputting those new values. So then in the next cycle, our registers are outputting our registers 8 and 9 that we got from the first instruction, and at the same time, we're reading the next instruction from memory. And we have out of memory coming the machine code for that instruction. So this means that the register file, as we're reading this memory here, is processing the previous instruction, reading register 8 and register 9, and sending them to these holding registers in front of the adder. So after we have that value, our add R10, R11 will proceed to doing the same thing in its decode step, and we will have the values for the adder sitting in these registers. So we'll have the actual register values, and also we got the value of the register we want to write to eventually, which we needed to pass through because the write-back stage is going to need it. So the add will actually happen, and at the same time as that add is happening, for our first instruction, our second instruction is going to be reading R10 and R11 from the register file. And this will proceed to the write-back stage, where our second instruction will actually do its add at the same time as our first instruction is actually modifying register 9 in the register file. So you end up with a timeline something like this. In this example, to make it clear which values are register numbers versus register values, initially each register has 100 times its register number, so 800 in R8, 900 in R9. So the net result is that we've executed our first instruction over 4 cycles. And during each of the cycles, we're doing something that, at the same time as other instructions, are using a different components. So we still get one instruction per cycle, but because we have less space from register to register, our cycle time is lower, so we have higher throughput, but our latency is higher because we take 4 cycles from the time that this instruction starts to when it finishes. So, any questions about how this pipeline works? Confusion, comments? Yeah?
So basically, whenever the clock cycle rises, there are values in registers depending on which state, are they in the registers?
Whenever the rising edge of the clock happens, the values in the registers change. Okay. And in the normal operation, they go from to having the values for the following instruction from what they had before. Everything at the same time. Other questions? So one question we might have is how much faster is this going to be? And that's going to depend on exactly how fast our components are. So here are some example delays that I just made up. But let's say our add2, that thing we use to compute the next program counter value, takes 80 picoseconds. Our instruction memory takes 200, our register file read takes 150, and so on. So without pipelining, we need to find the longest path through this. And there are two paths we can look at. So one path is the path from the PC, which is going to change at the rising edge of the clock, to the register file. The register file's write input, because the register file's write input needs to be correct at the next rising edge of the clock for it to write the correct value. So that path goes through the instruction memory, through the register file, through the add, and all the way to the register file again. So whatever the length of that is, is going to constrain us, and that happens to be 600 picoseconds. We have some other paths we could consider. So for example, another thing which needs to happen in a clock cycle is a value needs to go from the PC, go through this add2 circuit, and get back into the PC. If that can't finish in a clock cycle, we can't make the clock cycle that short. But fortunately, that takes 80 picoseconds, so it's a lot shorter than 600, so it doesn't matter. Only the longest path is going to constrain how much time we need to wait. And similarly, there's another path where we forward the value around, forward the value from the instruction into the register file to know what register number to write. And that's also shorter because it doesn't go through an adder. So it's 200 picoseconds, the time for the instruction memory and nothing else. But since that's shorter than our longest path, it doesn't affect the cycle time we need. So with pipelining, it's going to be the same concept. We need to worry about what's the slowest path we have to worry about from where we store something to where we store something. And that's going to be from a register to a register, or a register to the register file write input. So what's the longest path for that? And with these timings, the longest path happens to be the instruction memory's delay of 200 picoseconds. So just because the instruction memory is our slowest component, like the dryer was for doing laundry, it's going to constrain our cycle time. So we're going to need to spend at least 200 picoseconds plus however long the registers we have between the stages take. And that's going to be our time per cycle, which means that's going to be the time for every time we can put in a new instruction or get out the result of an instruction. So that's going to limit our throughput. And our latency, because we're spending time waiting for the instruction memory while the register file read is already completed, is higher. So instead of 600 picoseconds, we have 800 picoseconds plus four register delays. So we have that extra time because we didn't balance the work exactly evenly. So some of the time, say the add or the register file read is completed, but we still need to wait for some other instruction to do its instruction memory read. So this is how we're going to think about timing. So it's still a gain, but it's because of these uneven delays is not the huge gain it could be. And that's going to be a common thing that happens. So another thing I'd like to talk about with pipelining is how we're going to go about the process of adding things to our pipeline processor, what we need to remember. So let's say I want to modify our add processor to do other ALU operations. So what you do before is you just say, okay, we're going to replace the adder with an ALU, which takes an input on what thing to do. It can take an input to say, do an add or do an XOR or do an AND. And the easy thing to do is just run a wire from the function code in our instruction and just send that to the ALU. But if you just do this, that's not going to give you the right answer, because with this as it's drawn, we're going to be executing instruction one here, and it's going to be doing whatever ALU operation it's doing with whatever instruction two, instruction three, the two instructions ahead of it says to do. So that's not the correct solution. We always need to add pipeline registers whenever we move a value between stages. So we're going to need to only send values between stages for an instruction through registers. And if you don't do this, and this might happen when you're implementing things in HCL2D, you will get very confusing results, because some instruction that is completely unrelated, except it's in the same program, will affect the outcome of another instruction. Questions, comments? So I have this nice rosy picture so far that we just add these pipeline registers. So we follow this discipline of making sure we separate all the stages well, and that's all we need to do. But there are going to be some difficulties with that. So one difficulty is that there's something we don't handle well. So let's say instead of having different registers, we have some instructions which use the same registers, unlike every single example I've shown so far. So here, we're adding R8 to R9 and storing the result in R9. So if R8 contains 800 and R9 contains 900, that's going to give us 1700 in R9. And then we're taking that R9, that 1700 we computed, and adding it to R8 again and storing that in R8. So that's going to be 1700 plus 1800, which is 2500. But if we actually execute this on the pipeline I showed you before, we're going to, in our third cycle, we're going to read 900 and 800, because by our third cycle, we're just computing the value in the adder here for the next instruction. We don't even have the value yet that we want to read. So we can't possibly read the correct value. So we read the wrong value from the registers, and we get the wrong answer, and we store the wrong answer. So basically what our pipeline implementation is doing is we're reading both of the values for these two instructions and then writing their results. When the instruction set architecture specification is written, what we think Y86 is supposed to do, what our single cycle processor does, is that we do these one at a time. So we haven't preserved the illusion that instructions are executing one at a time, because they aren't. So we're reading this older value, something, some stale value that we're not supposed to have is leaking. So we're going to want to solve this because it's not very nice to implement a processor which gives you the wrong answer. Today I'm going to talk about two solutions. Next week we're going to talk about another solution. So the first solution I'm going to talk about is the simplest possible one. Let's not change our processor at all. Let's just change the instruction set. Let's say that, hey, if you're writing code and you want to use the result of this add, you need to wait two instructions. So if you want to use it right away, you need to insert two no ops. You can just change the ISA, change the Y86 specification to say, yep, all add queues, they add two numbers, and three instructions later, you get the result instead of right away. This is a real option you have, and you know, makes it the compiler's job to solve this problem, basically. But usually, it's not acceptable. I'm mentioning it because both because it's simple to do, and because real instruction sets do choose this option for some types of hazards. But it's not the one we're going to choose. But we're going to simulate the same effect. So here, we're inserting no ops explicitly. The compiler needs to write that. But what we're going to do instead is, let's say the hardware could do that for you. Let's say the hardware figures out, oh, you can't do that right away. I'm just going to run some no ops for you instead. I'm going to pretend you wrote two no ops there. And that's what we're going to do. And this is called stalling, because we stop in our tracks, not doing the work we're supposed to do. And this is obviously going to need some extra logic. In addition to detecting that you need to stall, we're going to need to sometimes not change the PC. We're going to be looking at this instruction, but we're going to say, oh, let's not execute it yet. Let's try to use the same PC next time and see if we're ready. And we're going to need to be able to put do nothing values in the pipeline register. So instead of passing something to the next stage of the pipeline saying, you're going to need to read these two values and add them, we want to pass something to the next stage, the pipeline saying, don't do anything. And once we've implemented that logic, which we'll talk more about how to do next week, we're going to get this sort of timeline, where we're going to have these two cycles of stalling, where we're not doing any useful work. And in this case, I'm taking advantage of our register file, assuming register 15 does nothing and doesn't store anything in particular. So we inserted two instructions of no useful work in what we passed from the fetch to the decode stage. Because in the fetch stage, we had some logic which recognized, oh, you can't do this yet. The value won't be ready, so you need to wait two cycles. And while we're doing that, we didn't change the program counter. So when we finally are ready to execute the next instruction, we have the program counter set to the right value. And since we've delayed this much, we end up with a correct execution. When this, in the third cycle, we're outputting 1700, the actual result of the first instruction, from this register here, which is the input to the data memory, to the register file. So during the third cycle, the register file is going to store 1700 into R9. And it's not until the fourth cycle that we have R9 in the register storing RA, that's our input to our register file. So we're in fact reading it after it's written. So we've delayed enough, so we're at least reading the value that is up to date and not some older version. Yeah?
Isn't it really at decode stage?
Yes.
So it's at cycle 5.
Sorry, on this diagram, I'm giving you the values that the register is outputting during that cycle.
I'm saying that you get 17, like 17 at cycle 3, and you got that 17 at cycle 5, right?
Yeah, so we store it in a register during cycle 5, so it had to be on the input to that register during cycle 4. Can we do, so what you want to do is read it here. So in this case, if we want to get the value into the register during cycle 4, that means during cycle 5, the register is getting 1700 as input and being told to write a that value into a register. And at the same time is being told to read the same register it's writing. And we expect it to read the new value. So whether that works or not is going to depend on what a register file does in that case. So for our single cycle processor, we don't want that behavior. We want it to be the case that when you read RSP and try to modify it in one cycle, that you don't start reading the new value of RSP you're computing, because that would not let us ever produce the right answer. But that might be a good idea for the multi-cycle, the pipeline version, to have the register file act that way. And we'll be doing something equivalent next week that will avoid some of this stuff. Other questions? Fusion? So those are our data hazards. So hazards in general are things which make our pipeline, the natural implementation where we just add registers, not produce the right answer. So data hazards are one kind, and the other most important kind is going to be control hazards. So control hazards are where we can't figure out what instruction we're supposed to run. So let's say we added conditional jumps to our add processor. I'm not going to draw how we're going to do that because we'll talk about that next week. But in this case, the conditional jump is going to need the value of our condition code registers. And if we think of when we're fetching the instruction that we need to run after this conditional jump, it's going to be, I have this off by one, but it's going to be while we're computing, doing the execute stage of the first instruction that actually sets the condition codes. So we're not going to have the right value for the condition codes yet. So that means that we're going to need to wait in order to know what instruction to fetch after the jump. So because sometimes we're going to fetch the target of the jump, and sometimes we're going to just fetch the next instruction. So we don't know what to get yet. And the simplest solution, again, is going to be to stall. Is that we're going to wait until this execute happens, and we actually write the value into the condition codes from the add. And we're going to delay executing the fetch stage of the instruction following the jump until we have that value to use. Because we need the result of the add first from the execute stage. So it's the same concept as what we did to deal with the data hazard, but it's just another thing we're going to need to look for and actually insert those delaying instructions into the pipeline registers in order to not do work for a couple cycles. And this is going to be a reason why we care about latency. Because the number of pipeline stages we have is going to affect how long we need to stall. So this is where the latency effect is going to be visible. So eventually when we you finally execute the instruction, and we still need to do something with the pipeline. This is a notable thing that will come up with some instructions. So what we've seen so far, the only time our later stages of our pipeline aren't doing anything is when we don't have, when we have to stall, when we don't have any useful work. But it's often going to be the case that we're going to still send an instruction through the pipeline because we need to spend a stage in the fetch to do it, even though there's no more work to do. And that's true for this jump instruction. All the work of the jump instruction is going to be done in our, in this model, in our fetch stage. But we still need to spend that cycle with all the other stages. Something needs to be in those pipeline registers. So we're going to send nothing to do through. That's going to be common. And that's not a problem with these pipeline processors. We're going to have a whole stage, the memory stage, where most instructions don't do anything. That's fine, because it's not going to change our throughput. It might change our latency, but it's not going to change our throughput. And that's what we really care about. So, questions, comments, fusion? Okay, so next week we're going to talk about doing this for the whole Y86 CPU. So we're going to take our five-stage CPU with our fetch, our decode, our execute, memory, and write back, and we're going to turn each of those into an independent pipeline stage, which takes some input from some registers and outputs something to some registers. And we're going to execute one of those stages per cycle, which means we're going to get one instruction per cycle, just like our single cycle processor. But if we do the computation, hopefully our cycle time will be much lower. But for whatever amount of time each of the components take, it's going to be a lot less. Probably not a fifth less, because some things might be slower or faster than others, but a lot less. And we're going to need pipeline registers between the stages. So we're going to add a whole lot of registers to do this. Ton of registers. Way more than I've shown. We're going to need a way of dealing with control hazards.
Yeah. Yeah, question. Can you go back a slide?
Sure.
So when you're doing this jump and you go to this NOAA, how do you get back to the add queue? Because now you're at a whole new PC value.
When you go to this, which NOAA? So
do this jump equals. Let's say if there's two add queues that use R9. So you jump.
Yeah.
To a NOAA. How do you get back to the next add queue? Because now you're at a new PC value.
So when we're inserting these NOAAs here in the hardware, we're doing it without changing the program counter. We're just saying there needs to be two NOAAs right before address 2. So we're going to hold down to address 2, and we're going to have to keep some extra state to know where we are. So not shown here is how we know that we're waiting 2 cycles. But that's not going to be part of the program counter, because the program counter better point to the instruction we want to execute.
So it's not really a jump equals, because jump equals changes.
So this is the jump equals, but we're executing the jump equals in 3 cycles. We're spending 2 cycles waiting, and then 1 cycle actually executing it and computing the value, which becomes the next PC. So good question. Yeah. So conceptually, we're inserting 2 NOAAs, but the NOAAs are just part of executing, the NOAA operation steps are just part of executing this jump equals, because its input isn't ready. And I haven't shown you a whole bunch of logic to figure out that after this first cycle, we need to wait 1 more cycle. We clearly need to store that somewhere, and because we're passing it between clock cycles, it better be in a register or memory somewhere. We can't just depend on knowing that magically. We can't make a wire which takes 2 clock cycles. Yeah?
So example here, the 1700, the next RDSTE, so that means the wire going into the next RDSTE has 1700, and the next clock cycle, when I go to 4, the value is actually going to become 1700.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is this jump equals implemented by the compiler, or is it just a part of the code?
Which part of the jump equals? This is our this is the rawest machine code assembly that is represented.
No, it's like
here.
Jump equals 0xFFF. Is that a part of, like, the compiler puts in, just guessing that you'll never put that, or that value will never be in R9?
No, this jump equal, this is an assembly program. So we have the machine code for jump equals, which is the opcode for jump, followed by a function code specifying equals, and then this immediate value 0xFFFF, which is an address to jump to. And that's literally what our processor sees. And our processor doesn't have two no-ops here. It needs to add that sort of delay itself.
But then once you get to the address, once you jump to the address OXFFF, how do you get back to whatever address at Q R10R?
You don't. So this is like a jump you'd use to implement an if, right? So if you were using this to implement an if statement, the if statement, this would be saying, you know, this would be the other part of the if, that you would never go to what follows in the other case. Yes?
I think people are confused. The jump equals and the two no-ops. The jump equals has to wait for the two no-ops to happen. The jump equals is not the no-ops themselves. If that, I guess he's explaining it, but I think that's the confusion.
That's the confusion? The jump equals needs to happen. Conceptually, the no-ops happen before the jump equals. So what we're doing is we're running two no-ops that no one requested before the jump equals, but we're executing the jump equals just as usual after we do that. Yeah?
So while those two no-ops, so to speak, are running, the program counter is not actually changing, it's just a built-in delay.
Yes. So we don't change the program counter because they aren't real no-ops. Yeah?
So when you add the no-ops, the hardware doesn't actually add it to the instructions, right? It just executes it?
Yeah, so we have our pipeline here. So what we're going to do to add the no-ops is we're going to have a mux in front of, say, these registers here, and we're going to put in the values that a no-op would have into those registers. We'll actually have a more convenient way of doing this with HCL2D, but the conceptual idea is that we have a mux in front of every single pipeline register that lets us put in the values that a no-op would put there, even if that's not what we read from the instruction memory. Yes.
I wasn't too sure in why we have to handle the control hazards and the data hazards in this specific way. I thought they would have been taken care of by the addition of registers such that the values would be correctly delayed.
So the issue is that we aren't communicating all our values through these registers. In particular, in this processor, we have one big thing which holds values that can communicate them between instructions, and that's the register file. And that does not properly delay things like our pipeline registers. And in our real processor, we're going to have a second thing which is going to do that, which is the program, which is the data memory. The data memory is not going to properly delay things between instructions on its own. We're going to have to make sure that that works. Yeah?
Instead of the no-ops, does the compiler put in different instructions? So if it was add QR8, R9, and then the next instruction could be add QR10, R11?
Yes, so there's something called instruction scheduling that compilers do. And that's where a compiler will take a case like this, where it knows that, if I could put those instructions there, but that will execute slowly because the hardware will insert no-ops for me. And it might say, I can't really do that. I don't really want that, rather. I could do that. So I'm going to put some useful work there. And that's the thing that compilers try to do. So with modern processors, this is less useful than you think, because we're showing you a pipeline processor that executes instructions in the order they're at. Modern processors try to do this themselves too. So they do this sort of reordering themselves, and that's very complicated, so we're not going to discuss how you do that in this class. But the processor will do that reordering too. So instead of executing NOOPs, it will find something to do, but there's a lot of logic about making sure that that doesn't change the outcome of the program. Yeah?
So is that efficient to reorder in that way? Because I feel like you would need a lot of computation just to figure out if that reordering would keep the program itself giving the same output.
Yeah, so as you'll discover when you do HTLTD, there's a whole lot of logic just to get the stalling correct. And the logic you need to implement that reordering is a lot. So for example, the MIPS R10000 is a well-documented processor which does this. It has about 4 kilobits to store register values, and about 2 kilobits to store bookkeeping about what instructions it's executing, in addition to the logic to actually use that bookkeeping. And that's not uncommon in a modern processor, that sort of level of bookkeeping. But it's worthwhile, it ends up, as long as you don't care too much about, say, the power or the area it uses. But it is a lot more complicated, so we're not going to do it in this class. We're just going to execute instructions in order, but we're going to add some extra logic to figure out when we need to stall, and some other techniques we're going to talk about next week that don't change the order in which we run instructions, but let us stall less than we would otherwise. Any other questions? Yeah?
Is it always two no-ops in the sense that the condition code is set earlier?
Yeah, so the number of stages we have to wait is all about where the instruction that we need the value from is going to be. So, for example, if we had another instruction after this add, which didn't involve our 9 or our 8, then we'd only have to wait one cycle, because the value would be still ready at the same time, and the instruction that was waiting would start one cycle later. So it's just about what the time at which the value we have is going to be ready, and that depends on exactly what stage it's stored in and when that instruction started relative to our current one. So it's not always going to be 2, it might be 1. In our real processor it might be 3. When you're starting out, you just have to look at when do we read the value and when is the value actually written. And you need to compare those. And it will depend on what exactly the instructions are and what value you're concerned about. Okay. So, yeah. So our task for next week is going to be to go over this whole, the whole processor, not just implementing adds, and what we're going to change to add pipelining to it. And for the most part, it's just adding these pipeline registers and handling these hazards. Handling these hazards is going to be a lot of work. It's going to be some pretty complicated logic to say, do we need to wait? It's conceptually easy to do, and I suspect that by hand, if I gave you a sequence of instructions and some paper and some time, you could figure it out, but that's not the same as writing a program which does it right every time and making sure that program isn't missing a case, is what you'll eventually need to do. The other thing that we're going to change a lot is we're going to need to be careful about how we compute the program counter. So there are some cases which are even worse than this, like return, where we need to get a value from the data memory, which is going to be several stages ahead. So we're going to need some more complicated logic to deal with that. And so, yeah, but today's main topic was just the general concept of pipelining is something you should know, and it's not going to just apply to processors. That's our primary application in this class, but this is an idea which has comes up in lots of other places, in circuits which aren't processors, and in making systems which just process data, but, you know, in software. And the whole idea is that you're taking the assembly line process, so where you're increasing throughput by increasing your latency. You're doing multiple things at once, and you're increasing your latency to pass values between those multiple places you're doing things. And it has these big limitations, which we need to worry about. We have this uneven division of work problem, and we have these delays, in this case for registers, but in general for just whatever mechanism we have to pass values between steps. And we have big problems with dependencies. Dependencies make it a lot more complicated and are going to be what we're going to spend most of our time on next week, is dealing with dependencies, what we call hazards. So I think that's what I have on pipelining for today. How about questions on, say, the test or quizzes? And I will, awkwardly pull up a, yes.
Where can you like view our, not the grade, but like
with TPEG. TPEG, so the site is, yeah. TPEG, I should bring up a window to type in with a large font size. It's tpegs.cs.virginia.edu, and you should be able to log in with your NetBadge login. And that's still not big enough. Okay, other, yes? I can.
Yeah, I was going to ask a question. One of them, remember there was two instructions you had to read. One was on like 0x0, one was 0xA. And then the second question, that one.
Okay, that question.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions from the test? I'll just collect them and then pull up a test. Go through.
The one where we have a bunch of, like, 6 or 7 bit operations, the one that's x plus y minus x and y, that shifted one is greater than or equal to x and y. I think it's choice C.
Okay, yeah. It's not choice C on every version, so.
Okay.
But x and y minus x plus y shifted.
X plus y minus x and y left shifted one.
Yeah, we'll find that based on that template. Other. Yeah, those are
the one where there's like a go-to cuts and flu and.
Okay, the go-to question. I think it's the only one. Other questions from the test people want to go over? Okay, so let's hopefully pull up an actual copy of the exam with answers, which I with answers. Not without answers. Okay, so we have a copy of the exam. So our, let's find the questions we were talking about. So first one, this question with the 0x0 and 0xA, I believe it's this one here. So the second one.
The order of the sub-question
series. Or at random. So which one did you mean?
Yeah, I want question 5.
Question 5, okay.
Yeah,
so question 5. So we tell you that R8 contains, somewhere up here. Yeah, R8 contains OXA. So R8 contains the address of this MR move Q instruction. So 0 plus R8 is the same address. So we're loading 8 bytes, starting with the first byte, that 50, 5008000, and so on. And we need to interpret that as little endian. So the 50 goes at the end. It's a byte. We don't reorder the numbers in the byte. So there's a 50 at the end. And then there's a 08 before that. And then it's all zeros. So we get 0x850. What? Sorry?
The address again?
The address? So, the address is 0 plus whatever's in R8. Because that's so it's memory to register. So the first operand is memory, and an amount operand that's memory has to be an address. So our address is formed by adding 0 to whatever's in register 8. We know it's in register 8 because we're told directly. And we have our instruction listings here, where the first line marks the address of the first byte of the instruction, which is the address of the instruction, as far as we set the PC, and every other time we refer to the address of the instruction. You seem confused still, so I think I'm answering the wrong question, but okay. So other question was confusion on the which one we find first. The go-to. So the go-to question, what happens here? So the easiest way to reason with this is to, just execute it by hand. Ideally, you'd write things down, which I'm not going to do since I do not have the right PDF reader in use. So first, x equals 2, y equals 2. If x is 2, 2 is not 0. It's true. So we're going to execute this go-to quax. So the next thing we're going to run is what's labeled quax. So when we get to quax, x and y are still 2. And we take exclamation point x, so which is x false? It is not, so we don't go to plug. So we execute the following line. We don't go anywhere. And then we subtract 1 from y. So y is now 1. So x is 2, y is 1. And y is not greater than or equal to x. So we don't do anything. And then we take 10 times x, which was still 2, plus 1, which is what y is 1, and get 21. So if I were actually doing this on a test, I would hopefully write down what was happening, because otherwise I'd be liable to make a stupid mistake, especially if I didn't have the answer right here already. Sure makes the problem easier. Yeah?
So when it says if x, that means go to that as long as x is defined as anything other than 0?
Yes. So in C, anything other than 0 is true. And this question.
Yeah, that's the one I asked about.
So, do we have this one?
Yes. Can you talk about it?
Yeah. Right. You should. You can guess who wrote this.
Okay. So, this may not be. Anyway, this is a question to see if you can walk through all the pieces. So x plus y minus x and y shift 1. So x and y shift 1 is the carry of addition. If a carry in where x and y were true, but the carry goes over one place. So this is x minus the carry of x. X minus the carry of x is just x. We have x plus y minus the carry of x plus y, which is just x or y, and x or is always greater than or equal to and. Yes?
When I asked about this earlier, we just considered 1 and 1 for x and y, and got 0 and 1, which didn't seem to make sense.
Sorry, you're saying if you put 1 and 1 in for, okay.
X and y are 1 and 1.
1 plus 1 is 2. Mm-hmm. X and y is 1. Shifted by 1 is 2. So I've taken the number, I've removed its carry.
Oh,
yeah, sorry. Okay, so this question is Steve. This question is missing. I apologize.
Yeah.
This was supposed to be an XOR, not an AND. So this question has no meaningful answer.
Okay.
We will redo that. Fortunately, we can easily redo that.
That's why.
Yes, that's why.
All right. You can do that. Okay, and that's time. So.